And speaking of rarities, we didn't talk about this, but were there recordings on cylinder even before 78s? Were there any preachers that are archived on cylinder that we could find?
Yes, this would be, in my opinion, this would be a wonderful research project because so much of the energy about religious broadcasting has been into radio.
KZMB, all zombie radio.
Tune in to WGXC on Saturdays and late nights after midnight for radio art, radio theater, sound art, experimental composition, free jazz, noise, and other experimental works. WGXC 90.7, Akron and Hudson, listener-supported hands-on radio for Green and Columbia counties.
Early Electromix is a series to document the history of experimental electronic music from the 50s to the 80s. Pioneers who paved the way for what was to become techno, ambient, electronica, and most of what we are listening to. Essential Culture on air every Tuesday from 11 to 12 a.m.
This is the Camp of Hudson Radio Group. We are excited to be a part of the WGXC radio family. It's fun, entertaining, we enjoy interviewing guests, and we like being around Tom Rowe, showing us the ropes. Most of the voices you hear on WGXC began as novices, with nothing more than a desire to share music or ideas with listeners. As a result of listener support, WGXC is now a framework by which volunteer programmers become radio makers, and local community continues to grow and knowledge of itself. Quote, while programs give freely of their time to make radio listener supported, radio is not free. It costs $10,000 every month to keep WGXC on the air. Please pledge what you can to keep the airwaves alive with the voices of your neighbors and friends in Columbia and Greene counties. To pledge, go to WGXC.org.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Alana Medlock of Kingston, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
These are dangerous times.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Patrick Tyne reports in the Times Union that on February 21st, a state attorney general's report found that former Saratoga Mayor Meg Kelly, former Saratoga Public Safety Commissioner Robert Dalton, and former Saratoga Police Chief Shane Crooks engaged in an, and I quote, unconstitutional official policy, end quote, of retaliation against members of the Saratoga Black Lives Matter group in the summer of 2021. Saratoga Black Lives leader Lexis Figueroa said the group would be filing a lawsuit against the city of Saratoga for actions the report says were, and I quote, conceived of and approved by the highest decision makers in the city government, end quote. Figueroa also said he would be seeking charges against the former mayor, Kelly, who, the report says, told the police to initiate an unfounded Child Protective Services investigation against him. Figueroa described the visit from Child Protective Services to his home, saying, and I quote, CPS was searching through our house, talking to my kids, making them talk to strangers during COVID, asking them, do your parents feed you enough? Do we beat you? Do we sell drugs? What we do for a living? Do we have guns in the house? That is the worst part of the report to me. It isn't what happened to me, it's what happened to my children and my chosen outlook in life, end quote. Current Saratoga Mayor John Safford said the city officials were reviewing the report and I quote, learning from its content and proceedings with the development and implementation of policies, procedures, and practices to address the recommendations made by the Attorney General's office, end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Brian Hubert reports in the Daily Freeman that Kingston Mayor Steve Noble met virtually with Mayor Vasyl Kozak of Sokerny, Ukraine, on February 22nd to sign a sister city agreement between the two municipalities. They posted on social media, and I quote, with this pact, Sokerny and Kingston pledge to work toward mutual beneficial exchanges that will strengthen our culture, society, and economies, and, as partners, will make every effort to promote peace and international understanding, end quote. About 1,700 residents from Sokerny are currently fighting in the war against Russia, and the city of about 8,000 has lost 97 lives so far. The social media post also said, and I quote, the city of Kingston stands ready to assist and support Sokerny in its war recovery and future endeavors, end quote. The Sister Cities International website at sistercities.org says the group seeks to, and I quote, promote peace and understanding through exchanges that focus on arts, culture, youth and education, business and trade, and community development, end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. The Local, a new performance space in Saugerties that opened last September in a former 1870s Dutch chapel, has been raising money to add a stage to the venue that has featured Spanish flamenco and tango music and West African highlife jazz and other styles. Their fundraising pitch says, and I quote, as intimate and cozy as Local is, it's nearly impossible to see the artists perform, and we are hoping to change that by purchasing a modular stage that will enable concert goers to see the artists better and add to the audience's experience, end quote. As of February 23rd, 87 donors have raised $13,454 of a $12,500 goal towards the new stage. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
New York lawmakers are calling on the EPA to keep dredging the Hudson River. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has sent a letter to EPA Administrator Michael Regan asking him to accept findings that the agency's earlier dredging efforts failed. Levels of polychlorinated biphenols, or PCBs, dumped into the river by General Electric are still high, making the water hazardous for nearby municipalities that use it as a primary drinking water source. Ned Sullivan with the nonprofit Scenic Hudson worries about the health impacts of these chemicals.
It is associated with cancer, neurological and respiratory disorders. The primary pathway for human exposure is eating fish. This is a big deal because there are people who are continuing to subsist on Hudson River fish.
The EPA has warned against eating fish caught in the river between Troy and Hudson Falls. An assessment by the group Friends of a Clean Hudson River finds current sediment recovery rates won't allow for natural recovery in fish. GE completed 2 of 3 sediment collection programs last year. A third program to collect deeper samples takes place this year. Other agencies have accepted that dredging failed. In 2015, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported GE didn't do enough dredging. Sullivan contends the primary reason previous efforts failed is because they weren't extensive enough.
Even before the cleanup was undertaken, it was known in public that there was roughly twice the amount of contamination that the cleanup plan was based on.
Once the EPA accepts the findings, the agency can examine different options for remediating the river, which will most likely be more dredging. However, Sullivan says that could change with emerging technologies. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Witnesses to genocide. Doctors describe horrors in Gaza's hospitals. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
Gaza has become a death zone,
says Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, director general of the World Health Organization, the WHO. As Israel's assault on the besieged Palestinian territory continues into its fifth month, statistics fail to describe the horror inflicted on the 2.3 million Palestinians trapped there. Gaza's hospitals have become battlegrounds themselves.
I've been to over 40 different countries, doing humanitarian work, anywhere from in Africa, Asia, and South America. And there, what I saw in Khan Yunis were the most horrific scenes in my entire life, and I hope I never see them again.
Said Dr. Yasser Khan, a Canadian ophthalmologist who recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. He was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The majority of the patients that I treated were children, anywhere from the age of 2 to 17. I mean, I saw horrific eye and facial injuries that I've never seen before. Eyes shattered in 2 6-year-old children with shrapnel that I had to take out. Eyes with shrapnel stuck inside, facial injuries. I saw orthopedic injuries where, limbs just cut off and dangling. I saw abdominal injuries that were just horrific, and it was just mass chaos. There's children on the floor, unattended to, with head trauma, people suturing patients without anesthesia on the ground.
Southern Gaza's largest health facility, Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, stopped functioning on Sunday, February 18th, following a week-long Israeli military siege and raid. Dr. Ahmed Maghrabi, chief of plastic surgery at Nasser, sent Democracy Now! A video describing when Israeli troops stormed the hospital at 1:30 Sunday morning.
They bombed and chilling the third floor where I'm staying. Exactly, they targeted the orthopedic department. It was like chaos. Everybody running there and there. So I realized that it is invasion of IDF. As I started hearing some dogs at the hospital, yeah, they destroyed the back wall of the hospital and release their dogs. I changed my scrub immediately, and I took this my clothes. Actually, I bought this my clothes, and I ran away from the hospital with my family, with many of patients.
Videos Dr. Maghrabi shared show blood-covered patients being dragged on gurneys along hospital corridors through dust and smoke-choked hallways lit only by flashlight. Days later, after being blocked by the Israeli army for 2 days, a team from the WHO made it into Nasser Hospital. One team member, Chris Black, posted a video describing the scene and their efforts to transport the most threatened patients.
It's a heartbreaking situation. This hospital is the most important referral hospital south of Wadi Gaza. It's now on its knees. The entire neighborhood around here is damaged and destroyed. The hospital itself has no electricity, has no food, has no water. There's very few doctors and nurses. They're living here in the premises, working around the clock. WHO, OCHA, and the colleagues from UNICEF were trying our best to get at the most critical patients here. Working with the director of the hospital, he's identifying them. We're trying to move them out. It's a slow process. We have 4 ambulances from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. We can put 2, maybe 3 patients at the most in these ambulances. The road coming in here is very, very hard to manipulate. We're going to be back here as long as it takes to make sure the patients that need more medical care can get to it where they need to.
The World Health Organization is one of a score of agencies and organizations that comprise the Interagency Standing Committee, which coordinates global humanitarian aid. The committee issued a blistering statement Wednesday addressing the overall situation in Gaza. It read in part, quote, "The health system continues to be systematically degraded with catastrophic consequences. As of 19 February, only 12 out of 36 hospitals with inpatient capacity are still functioning, and only partially. There have been more than 370 attacks on healthcare in Gaza since 7 October. Diseases are rampant. Famine is looming. Water is at a trickle. Basic infrastructure has been decimated. Food production has come to a halt. Hospitals have turned into battlefields. 1 million children face daily traumas," unquote. Dr. Irfan Galeria is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon who volunteered in Gaza with the humanitarian aid group Med Global. He wrote an op-ed published in the Los Angeles Times with the chilling headline, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war. It was annihilation." Speaking on Democracy Now!, Dr. Galeria described Israel's...
was a deliberate attempt to incapacitate the healthcare system. The healthcare system in Gaza has collapsed. Hospitals have been targeted. They no longer have the physical capacity or space to care for their patients. Physicians are being killed. Healthcare workers are being killed. They're being targeted. They're being imprisoned. There's no medical aid or medical equipment that's coming through.
Dr. Galeria concluded,
"I've been in war zones. I've operated in small hospitals in Africa. I thought I was going to be prepared, but I was not prepared for what I saw here."
Targeting hospitals, as Israel's doing in Gaza with U.S. complicity, is a war crime. On Tuesday, a U.N. Security Council ceasefire resolution received a 13-1 vote. The U.S. was the sole no vote, using its veto power to kill the resolution, allowing the mass killing in Gaza to continue. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now, here is your WGXC Weekend Weather Report. The National Weather Service in Albany is forecasting a mostly sunny Saturday with a temperature high near 29 degrees and a north wind at 14 to 16 miles per hour. Tonight it will be mostly clear with a temperature low of around 13 degrees and a northwest wind at 6 to 11 miles per hour. On Sunday, tomorrow, it will be sunny with a temperature high near 38 degrees and a west wind and south in the afternoon. On tomorrow night, a slight chance of snow showers after 1 a.m. degrees. And that is your weekend weather report from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Edelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support. WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Accra, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
All the children, turn the lights. This is it, the night of nursing and nursing apart. We know every card by heart. Oh, mature, curtain lights, this is it. We'll hit the heights, and oh, what heights we'll hit. On with the show, this is it.
Next, we tune in the latest episode. Of the I Have Seen Niagara radio theater show from G. Lucas Crane and Rick Royer. The show airs Saturday mornings on the WGX every early Wednesday night, just after midnight.
Seeping low over Niagara Falls, an orange cloud congealed around the gas station, as it had every morning that month. The bright pumpkin apricot clouds swirled past the pumps and wafted densely around the large rectilinear window. People passing through to pump gas seemed wide-eyed and concerned upon exiting their cars, but the staff was used to it by now. They had higher priorities. This particular Tim Hortons leaned heavily into its coffee service and were proud of it. And their efforts regularly made the morning rush a spectacle of glorious efficiency. The remarkable ease with which everyone entering was able to successfully serve themselves coffee, add any traditional embellishments or accessories, and get out of the way for the next person was elevated to the height of a dance. With everything made so easy for them, the regular morning coffee hounds were put into somewhat of an instinctual competition to see who could avail themselves of coffee and dance out of the way the fastest. Everyone involved was proud of their inclusion in this dance of the morning Joe. The customers rushing about, the staff standing at the ready. This was, regularly, the morning's main event. It was a thing of beauty. It was competitive. And its competitive beauty was the reason the orange cloud chose to gather here every morning. More than anything, it loved to watch the humans compete. For several millennia on the planet Earth, the orange cloud had been watching the humans compete in what they sometimes call sports, and relishing in the human propensity for glory, for mythic physicality, for feats of spectacle, for the heights of valor, and inevitably, for the grinding, bloody failure. The cloud loved it all. The ones where the huge teams of people fight over a sphere with their feet, to the ones where just two people hit each other until death with sharp sticks, to the ones where a single person stabs a baby human in a crowded collegium. The cloud had congealed with glee for every human sport and competitive endeavor. The delicate interactions and the subtle variation each human used to solve their particular sports puzzle was never not fascinating. From the jockeying gossip and expert insults of donkey women by the lowly Caledonian River, to the initiation champion dripping with sweat and blood on a pile of defeated enemies, the cloud loved how the humans came to meet each other over their various interests. Ever since the cloud was created in the center of a circle of granite columns nestled in a glade of sycamore trees by a group of autumnal wizards, it had found all humans wondrous and transfixing. The wizards were trying to use sky magic to leech their childlike wonder, fear, and empathy for others from their hearts in order to withstand a coming plague and pogrom. Instead, their ritual had impossibly reached through the gossamer threads of cosmic space and summoned the Storm of Iolanthe itself, the tenth veil of the Shankara Maya, the third aspect of the severing mollusk of the Great Trench, corporealized on this plane as a shifting ochre-orange cloud, forged immortal as a sentient cloud-like dimensional fracture, an orange wisp of timeless wonder. The wizards were all yelling and crying in failure, and the cloud had wrenched itself from their despair and shifted across the sunlit grassy hills of the surrounding countryside. It ran right into a ribald game of Joshua Goat, involving 12 children and 4 goats. It was amazing how expert the children were, and how the goats were good at the game too. Unique, no, triumphant expertise. This was truly wondrous. After this strange birth, the cloud knew what it was interested in and what its ultimate purpose was: to spectate. And what was the orange cloud doing in Niagara Falls? Why, to furiously spectate at its favorite sport in centuries, a monthly child fight club that's run out of the woods near a cemetery called Upstate Mex. The orange cloud had been watching this group form for the last year after catching the jet stream over from the Sepik Takraw tournament in Vietnam. The origins of any child fight club are fragile and vulnerable, owing to how upset it always seemed to make the humans eventually. And yet, for a brief time, no human is more daring, no human is more focused, and no one is more a bundle of instincts and innovation as is a child working their way up to fight another child. And this fight club had the most careful and organic of origins. It all started with a love of woodworking. Sam and Tyne Bramble, not their real names, were 12-year-old twins from Niagara Falls, New York. And once for their birthday, they had been given only one smartphone between them, since they were never apart, and also a Dremel set, which they carried everywhere, in holsters.
A Dremel is a proper gift for any lad.
They started an Instagram account and began carving small objects from wood and posting videos constantly. Their parents were checked out, but wealthy, and the twins were plagued with insomnia, which only made them grind wood and post to Instagram harder.
I know they have a word for this. No sleep good syndrome.
Within a few months, they had built a large following by fixating on strange carved wooden jewelry. Four-finger rings of mahogany, often invoking gloves, and odd decorative loops that you were supposed to carry around, or small crowns carved from cedar that pinned to your hair. It was unique, and the twins said all manner of precocious things as they revealed their hobby to the masses.
It's really easy. It's really easy to use. I mean, be careful, but it's easy.
The twins often pivoted back and forth from woodworking curiosity.
The history of decoration is incredible.
To quasi-dire descriptions of their insomnia.
I needed something for my hands to do.
They became quite popular. Thousands of people waited anxiously for their usual 3 a.m. wood video drop, and invitations to talk shows and woodworking societies flooded in. But the twins were insular and obsessive and seemingly uninterested in fame. They were building a strange brand bubble of wooden jewelry, and that consumed them. On the side, like many teen boys, they watched the fighting robot shows. Then one day, a friend visiting their shop asked them to make him a power gauntlet and a GN sword and maybe a helmet, if they had the time, for a convention he was going to. Like a thundercloud gathering over a drought-ridden field, the twins discovered their secret calling: wooden robot armor. Their interests, woodworking, not sleeping, and fighting robots gelled together very well. They put time into learning about how the robots could be constructed as actual suits of armor, sized for their peers.
I wanted it to be raw, but then I got into decoration.
Soon, every kid in the neighborhood wanted their own helmet and gauntlet and arm-mounted shield. The boys threw themselves into the requests, binging on gummy worms as the floor filled with sawdust. All the while, they kept up making jewelry and delighting in the increasingly fake world of their public Instagram jewelry brand. wholesome, delicate, feminine, and a little gothic, and their secret world of nasty, brutish, functional robot armor for children, which they were keeping off the internet. More and more local children approached them, and without really trying, the twins began to dictate the secret fashion of Niagara's children.
When I started out, I really found all the random wood very compelling. I liked it. Just felt good around it. The fighting came later.
Someone had the brilliant idea of meeting up in the woods to show each other their Salmon Time robot armors. Like some sort of show, they planned to convene after any new piece by the twins was due to be finished. The twins would work for a month on some kid's armor, and then word would spread in excitement to see the new work would build. This became regular monthly meetups. This led very quickly to dueling. Little wrestling matches. The armor was well made and built for functioning as real armor. The twins had taught themselves this new skill world of industrial wooden armor manufacturing.
Cams, pistons,
blade winses, universal degreaser, pneumatic agent, rear servo mechanism,
axis,
front piece,
gear handles,
probe greaves,
winches,
Alfen hammer,
star winches,
Wendigo bunting,
torching,
daisy mail,
magnet, trundle hopper.
They got right down to a real process, innovating wildly. The Niagara children would leave their homes under the cover of darkness dressed like robots, the wooden suits imparting a spectral air of anonymity and feral robotic strangeness. There were rumors in the adult world of sightings of 5-foot robots eating candy, running around town. But anytime they were encountered at night, any adult that saw a robot just figured that their eyes had gone crazy. In this age of limitless surveillance and reflexive posting, this was the rare, well-kept secret. Upwards of 30 children, all meeting in the woods dressed like robots. The twins took on increasingly organizational duties, creating complex competition brackets and betting odds. The kids ate this stuff up, getting pumped up for the matches and bragging to each other in niche robot gamer weeboo language inscrutable to adults. Each meetup was getting more intense. Some kid's cousin visiting from the city who actually showed up with concessions and sold hot dogs and sodas nicknamed the meetups Upstate Mechs, and the name stuck. A group of local 10-year-old crypto 100,000-aires ran sponsorships for the best downtrodden child gladiators from the neighborhood and began to incorporate child fighting into their usual boyish crypto schemes. Only kids under 16 were allowed to compete. They developed weight classes and rules for aging out.
Hey, wait a minute. You should make a fight club.
You should make a fight club.
Someone said after there had already been 45 matches in 6 months. This was becoming their whole world. The sounds and feeling of wooden robot battle, the crunch and bonk of wooden robot wrestling and swordplay became their paradise. The real world of Instagram and jewelry melted away.
I have become death. Something, something. I have become death.
Their Instagram brand was continued on an even keel, but they worked hard to hide their real life, that of weapons merchants and bookies and fight promoters. To them, it all felt very healthy. Healthy in a crazy world.
Gosh, guys, I really feel like we've come together as a family after all these fights. I've really learned a lot.
The world of battle that the twins had created was a secret, a rare occurrence on the planet Earth. To watch these battles was to see humanity laid out for all. This is how Upstate Mechs, Fight Club for Children, caught the eye of a 3,000-year-old sentient orange cloud that loved human sports more than anything. This is why the cloud had descended upon Niagara Falls. It was game night. The coffee service rodeo at the Tim Hortons was just the cloud's morning warm-up. This evening, the pint-sized gladiators were gathering in their constructed wooden suits, blocky and brutal against the fading summer light of the forest. The cloud settled into its favorite spot, the small clearing in the break between the log bleachers that the children had built after the first club meet. As the cloud settled its orange ochre haze over the stumps of cut trees in the little lot, the children waiting in the fighting dugouts buzzed with excitement. It had not gone unnoticed that an opaque orange cloud showed up and settled in the exact same spot every time the Upstate Mechs kids met to fight it out. It was clearly an omen, a polluted monument to their glory as gladiators or something. It was something special.
Looks like this guy's ready to split some skulls, folks.
The omen had come. The fight was on.
JP brought his platinum cutter, and we're all excited to see what he does with it. I just have a feeling. Look how excited. excited Larry is.
The newest controversy or trend that the twins had presided over ever since the championship game 2 months ago was the growing popularity of medieval-style armor and weaponry spreading into their commissioning requests. Fighting robots you can climb inside were always popular, but so was video gaming. And that Elden Ring game had just come out and everyone was playing it in the town. The kids were getting into the Dark Souls series. And even though the biggest child event in town was called Upstate Mechs and involved dressing up in wooden robot armor, no one batted an eye when the next meetup had a few medieval knights mixed into the combat. They were the new crowd favorite, in fact.
Detestable dragon for the win.
The twins, in their obsessive secretness, pivoted in interest and passion to the reconstruction of the famous armors from the games. Solaire of Astora, and the Iron Golem, and the Tree Sentinel, etc. They made greaves and breastplates and gauntlets and wooden chainmail alongside the fin funnels and beam sabers the kids were still asking for. This new trend pleased the Orange Cloud greatly, as it had only experienced esports that one time in Korea, and the incongruity and creativity on display as medieval knights in full rosewood plate mail squared off against the giant robot returning champions, the Devil Gundam and the Seven Swords Double Zero, who were both out of the dugouts giving a joint interview for some kid's blog. The strange live video game reality pleased the multidimensional being. It worked on several planes of existence at once. So it appeared to the Cloud that this month's main event competition was going to be knights versus robots, and that was something it hadn't seen in 1,000 years.
There's a great amount of talent here.
The other spectators, like any clandestine meeting in the woods in Niagara Falls, includes various strangers from around the area who are off the beaten path, including a contingent of talking animals from the woods, various washed-up or on-the-make daredevils, local homeless citizens, extreme gambling addicts who wouldn't be denied, unethical crypto shills, and people who knew of the matches through that other Discord channel. The wildcard rounds begin. First in the pit is a Bloodhound Knight in full maple plate mail versus a Birchwood Mortise and Tenon Destiny Gundam. They hooted at each other, the knight getting down on all fours for some reason, brandishing a huge curvy sword. The robot flexed like a bodybuilder and shook its fins. The arena was filled with the sound of moving wood and staccato clonking. The knight scampered toward the robot, swinging its sword wildly, and the crowd whooped approvingly. The Orange Cloud could hear the twins talking loudly from their tent headquarters on the edge of the field.
That's right. It's the most popular secret child fight club on the East Coast.
It was a festive atmosphere of ritual combat. Everyone seemed proud. Being a diffuse body, the Orange Cloud enjoyed multiple perspectives at once. At the edge of himself, he could see some of the animal spectators. There were a few owls and assorted birds, a big rat group, a few deer laying around. There were also some apes dressed in gray uniforms. The apes were sitting together, but spaced apart, chatting to the other animals. They didn't appear to be very concerned about the fight. One particular ape with reddish fur, wearing a cap, began shrieking at a snooty eagle. He reared back as the eagle flapped its disapproval.
Oh, my word.
The ape stamped his feet, huffing and growling, banging on the ground. And as it watched the Bloodhound Knight tackle the pointy robot, the Orange Cloud was getting nervous. The Orange Cloud didn't want anything bad to happen to his precious fight club. The eagle said something like,
"So many painfully forced plot holes. Disgusting."
The red ape shrieked, suddenly louder than the sounds of the match, and every neck snapped over to the bleachers. The ape reached over and grabbed a huge log the size of a motorcycle and threw it into the ring. The log landed with a crash between the two combatants, momentarily separated in their ongoing match. There was a great gasp from the crowd. The sound was covered by the red ape continuing to tear at the nearby hot dog cart, ripping metal and throwing its contents everywhere. The crowd gave way to shield itself and burst over the railings into the arena. But the Bloodhound Knight had just about defeated that robot. This would not do. The careful balance of the most unique child fight club on the East Coast was being ruined by the chaos of a rampaging ape. The Cloud couldn't just do nothing. This can't be how it ends. It didn't usually intervene in the human affairs, but its instincts and reactions in this case were brought on purely by the extreme love it had for this sport, these kids. The cloud deepened in ochre color, drawing its particles together, churning its resolve into little whirlwinds and billows, and rushed all at once like a discharging fire extinguisher into the arena, becoming thick and opaque suddenly, engulfing everyone in a swoop of its swollen tendrils. Wails of confusion from the crowd gave way to small, strangled gurglings as the exposure to the orange cloud took effect upon those inside. Now, I'm sure the orange cloud had good intentions, but alas, as a millennia-old pan-dimensional being, the effects of being trapped in this sports planet cloud were decidedly uncommon. The original wizards who summoned it to this plane were trying to divest themselves with ambiguity, and so the interior of the cloud was, from every perspective, in the most ambiguous state it could ever be in. The ancient cloud was secretly a rare sort of temporal and spatial breach, bopping along, thinking about the World Highlight Championships. Usually it was all fine, but depending on how thick or excited the cloud was, anyone wandering into its apricot ochre depths would have their brains spectrally transported through time and space into the body of another person, someone who had entered the cloud at a sporting event, either far into the future or deep into the past. Within the cloud was always the same place, the same time, holding out for the Bills to sweep the Super Bowl, or complaining about the cheating at the Sumo Grand Tournament, where time and space were a mental state, and no one really ever leaves. Maybe it was all the Schlitz, or maybe you've been paid a visit by the orange fog. The interior of the cloud is opaque and wet, as if a storm cloud had descended to Earth, a thick prickly gale of a fog. It was like standing on a cliff in front of a stormy orange sea, and that sea is a boiling cauldron of orange stars hanging in a limitless orange space. When you enter the cloud, you might not even notice that your brain has been switched, because you'd be stumbling around in a thick squall, but now you're in medieval England or Bronze Age Africa, two places and times the orange cloud has gone on sports pursuits. You will see out of the eyes of someone else. You will look down to see other hands. You will encounter each other at a stormy orange crossroads.
Last thing I knew, I was loading hay into the back of Bartholomew's cart. He was doing me a favor.
And now, at this point in history, when a large contingent of people entering the cloud are dressed in full wooden armor and articulated robot suits, the benefit of the twins' woodworking skills, their passion, their artistry, plus the aesthetic dissonance of knights versus robots, are now delivered via mythical cloud magic to the denizens of all of time.
On the hill, there my honor still lays. I was kept from true glory by some monster. This storm is a curse.
Anyone who has ever or who will ever enter the cloud again is likely to encounter a confused 4-foot black knight with a sword as large as they are, stumbling against the storm.
I don't remember who I am.
I hear the call.
Real knights from the past now have a chance to inhabit the body of a 5-foot tall robot named Barbatos, and an ancient Roman merchant who is obsessed with pugilatus can now find themselves struggling through an orange storm, dressed as the dancer of the Boreal Valley.
Where is your lord?
Even through this storm, I still will remain ready for battle, ready for battle, ready for battle, ready for battle, ready for battle.
First of all, there's a massive hole, and you can't see that. But there are wires strung up. There's a cloud chamber.
We don't have any idea.
It's gonna smoke you out.
Going on everyone.
To look at the immobilized cloud. See a true light on the portal.
Give us a minute, folks.
Oh, gosh, I miss the hours of focusing like that. There's a tree, a forest, with riftes. And behind the wet fronds, there's a mere tree with false drift. Don't go into the one. You'll know that another door. But it's a fancy purple waste tree. Shift of energy field. Don't go into the left side. Don't hang on the door brace. Don't clog up the entrance. And don't forge ahead. Okay.
It became legendary, notorious among the other fight clubs. The entire mind time traveling orange storm cloud affair, in which everyone switched their brains with each other and the people of the distant past and the future. The entire event goes to hell in a wet storm cloud of chaos and temporal confusion, where talking animals from Corfu were stumbling around with the minds of 19th century Hungarian pole vaulters poking out of them. You can bet that that entered the history books. The twins couldn't pass up this opportunity to brag. since it all disassembled into a chaotic, difficult-to-remember period, and everyone woke up in their beds the next morning dressed in half-robot, half-plate mail, it was conventionally decided that the whole thing would be chalked up to food poisoning and swamp gas. And the twins decided to tighten their security, screen the apes a little better. The Orange Storm, as it came to be known, became just another big, blurry spot in the complex history of one of the best fight clubs Niagara Falls has to offer. Send us $3 American and we'll send you a list of the best bare-knuckle cosplay brawls happening monthly in the Rattlesnake Hill Wildlife Management Area. If you like to hear these stories and greet them with your wonder, consider subscribing to our Patreon and help us produce these audio adventures. Just $3 gets you a list of fight clubs. Just kidding, I mean access to our special secret seasonal episode, deepening your connection to Niagara and the other wizards in the Cave of the Winds. Subscribing for more lets you into the world of participating in how we write these tales. Check out the link in the episode description, and remember, once you have seen the falls, they fall forever inside your mind.
Most radio shows don't come with a demonstration, but most radio shows aren't Radio Wonderland.
Greatest hits.
During the emotion, what's love got to do? Got to do, 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 got to do.
Right, so then I take more pieces of live radio, slice them, fit them into the groove. And then in a few minutes, you get something like...
In LA, some restrictions apply.
It's radio made completely out of radio. I'm Joshua, but you just call me Radio Wonderland.
10:30 a.m. Saturday mornings till 11.
Some restrictions apply.
February 24th, 2024 marks 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. This day will be marked by a special benefit screening of the Oscar-nominated documentary 20 Days in Mariupol at Time and Space Limited in Hudson, New York, organized by Medical Relief for Ukraine in cooperation with Ukraine Solidarity Capital District. Cameron, thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Cameron Melville from Hudson, New York. I was one of the owners of Club Helsinki, which was a great community venue, music venue in Hudson that's since closed. I got actively involved in Ukraine actually a couple months before the Russian invasion and have been extremely involved since, working with regional Ukrainians and others to raise money for medical relief.
I realize this is a big question, but 2 years into the invasion, what is your assessment of what's happened and how do we move forward in this sad anniversary?
Yeah, well, we move forward by persevering and standing strong and keeping our eye on the ball. It's a very, very confusing environment, media environment, and every other kind of environment. People are exhausted, certainly on the ground in Ukraine. Donors, I mean, everyone is exhausted, tired, and it's easy to let discouragement creep in. I remain confident that this Ukrainian military funding is going to pass Congress. And I think the world needs to stay focused, certainly the United States and Europe, on stopping Putin. I think it's an existential threat to democracy. So, you know, in the beginning, there was incredible commitment. There always has been, certainly in the Ukrainian community. But it's a hard slog, and but we need to keep our eye on the prize, which is driving the Russians out of Ukraine.
How important has relief aid been in supporting people who are still in Ukraine?
It's been hugely helpful, and there are an awful lot of people doing it. I do it actually in three or four different protocols. One is through our organization, Medical Relief for Ukraine. We support several doctors and medical institutions on the ground. Next Step Ukraine, which is affiliated with Revival Soldiers of Ukraine, is one of our partner nonprofits that we support. Irina Verchuk is the director, I believe, of Next Step, and they do post-prosthetic rehabilitation, and they now, I believe it's the first medical rehab in Ukraine set to American medical standards. They've been open a couple of months, and we also support other doctors and people working for medical relief on the ground.
So the film, the Oscar-nominated documentary 20 Days in Mariupol, what is the film about?
So this is our second movie event. The last one also was at Time Space Limited in Hudson, which is a great venue that is made available for a variety of different political and community events. The first movie we showed was Winter on Fire, which is an incredible documentary about the Maidan uprising of 2014 and 20 Days in Mariupol. So when the Russians went on the move on the February 24th, one of their first invasions and occupations was the city of Mariupol. It was typically brutal in typical Russian sense, horrible. And it was a civilian humanitarian disaster. And that's what the movie is about, is that those first 20 days. We also, and it's an incredible documentary, as you said, it just actually last week it won more awards in England. I don't remember the name of the award offhand, but the reason we chose to show this is to remind people, you know, people get, there's so much media and so much news and so much information and disinformation that people get a little desensitized to things. And this is to remind people of just how bad it is, how bad it can be, and how bad it was, and why we need to resist the Russians. And in addition to the movie, we have four videos that we made, Medical Relief for Ukraine. We reached out to two doctors who were in Mariupol for the first 20 days and were continuing with their medical care with no electricity, no water, et cetera. And then we also have a woman who was a civilian in the city who was under fire, and also a soldier who was part of Azovstal, which was the brigade, the Ukrainian military brigade, that was holed up in the steel mill there for a long time, and it was a horrendous situation. He was repatriated by the Russians in a prisoner exchange, and he is now sort of a rock star in Ukraine. He goes by Mr. Wikipedia because he's so smart. The movie starts at 1:30. Doors are at about 12:15. We encourage people to get there by 12:30. TSL has a nice gallery and cafe. There'll be refreshments. People can mingle and meet. There'll be some interesting folks there. Participants, members of participating organizations. There will be a Q&A discussion, so it'll be a combination. We're actually going to break the documentary into two parts. There'll be an intermission, So we'll have a couple of our videos and half of the documentary, and then again, two videos and finish up with the documentary. And it should be very educational. It's not a walk in the park. It's a dark subject, but it's something we need to not turn away from and educate ourselves about. So we are trying to help people do that.
And attending this event is to support relief efforts. Is that right?
Yeah, all proceeds for the event go to medical relief for Ukraine. 100% of those donations go to medical relief.
And yep. Where can listeners find more information?
So the website of our organization is MR, is in medical relief, MR, the number 4 in the word Ukraine, mr4ukraine.org. You should be able to buy tickets there. Also, Time Space Limited, which is the name of the venue in Hudson. You can go to their website. I believe it's timeandspace.com.
Cameron, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. As we mark this sad second anniversary, what would you like to leave our listeners with?
Don't forget about Ukraine. And again, with all the madness that is happening in nationally, internationally, with all the distraction, the importance of this does not diminish. So I would encourage people to remember that and spread the word.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, what we've been talking about, we've been teasing this interview, and now it's about time to do it.
Yes, this is our New York State Lieutenant Governor, and he is the first, he was the first Black African-American person to be a congressman in upstate New York. And we're very proud that it was our 19th district that he was Congress representing. He's also now the first Black African-American person to be lieutenant governor in New York State, and that is Antonio Delgado, also a husband and father and all-around good man. So let's hear this conversation that we had with him.
Here we go.
This is our Black History Month edition. And we are so delighted to have with us not only a history maker, a Black African-American history maker, but the Lieutenant Governor of the state of New York, our home state. Snaps and claps to Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. Cheers. Do we have a sound machine for that?
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me.
So happy to do that. Also wanted to acknowledge and thank you for your executive assistant, Jacob Saltzman, who's just been so wonderful in accommodating us when we're reaching out to you. So I want to give him snaps and claps and cheers too. Yes.
All right. Excellent.
So before we get into the conversation for today, I want to just ask, how is Mrs. Delgado and Maxwell and Coltrane? How are they doing?
Well, thank you for asking. They're doing very well. The boys are thriving. They're in fifth grade and excited about, you know, the next big step in education for them, middle school, where they have to, you know, get outside of just one classroom and move around. So that's exciting for them. The big news in our house is that we ended up getting a dog last summer. And so kids are in love with him. His name is Leroy. and Lacey's great as well. She's, you know, busy with her career and focusing on how she wants to keep having an impact in her own ways. And everybody's healthy. So thank you for asking.
Absolutely. Listen, I have a grandson. He's in the fifth grade and he has a lizard and he named him Levi. So maybe these guys may have to meet, you know.
Levi and Leroy. That sounds like a comic strip. Something like that. Leroy and Levi. I like that.
Okay. So Lieutenant Governor. Okay. So for our audience who may not know you, we like to just introduce, and we usually invite our guests to do a self-introduction, but there's so much that you have done. So I'm just going to chime in, and then I'll let you come in as well if there's anything you want to fill in. But okay. I know that you're a Rhodes Scholar, that you graduated Harvard Law School, that you worked in corporate law, but you did pro bono work for the criminal justice reform. and that you then went into Congress and became the first Black African-American person of color to be congressman in upstate New York. And now you are the Lieutenant Governor of New York State, married with children and born and raised in Schenectady, I think. Yeah.
I mean, I would say, you know, I always like to start with helping people know that, you know, so much of my childhood was in the church growing up. So, you know, being a person of faith and being raised in the church from, you know, being a little boy, you know, always sort of informs every other step that gets laid out, you know, whether it's education, whether it's career, you know, it's all grounded in sort of the value set that I learned, you know, culturally, what I was exposed to, the standard of excellence that my parents, you know, expected from me, and just a understanding.